Welcome to In It to Win It. This is Steve Barton, and thank you for tuning in. We have back on the show our resident uranium expert, Justin Hume. Justin, thanks for coming back on the show.
Good to be back. How are you doing, Steve?
I'm doing just fine. I'm doing good. Thank you. You took a little vacation, right? You guys went camping or what?
I did. We went and visited just kind of the desert Southwest. We went into kind of the southern area of Utah, and then the second leg of the trip went down to West Texas, but we ended up spending our time in that area in New Mexico at the White Sands National Park. So it was beautiful. My wife and I both just really, really love the desert. We got married in the desert. We go out there a couple times a year. But this area I've never been to, and it was stunning, just absolutely stunning.
Nice. Yeah, I like camping and going out into the desert and stuff too, and the mountains and fishing and all that. So it's a lot of fun right up my alley.
Definitely. Yeah.
Good deal. All right. Well, let me start off with our patented saying here. We are not financial advisors. Do not take this as financial advice. Do your own due diligence. This is simply what Justin and I are doing. So your vacation, I go back to work here pretty soon. Oh, you know, something happened to me recently that I didn't think would ever happen. And I got a stimulus check. And I thought, wow, the government in its infinite wisdom sees fit to send a single male with no dependents who's a millionaire a stimulus check. That's going to fix the inflation problem. Way to go, government. I'm like,
wow,
what is the next step? I think it's price fixing, you know. I really do. I think, mark my words, Justin, I think that's what's coming. I think it's going to be price fixing next, and that'll somehow solve the problem, right?
Always does.
Yes. It's never worked before in history for any government, most recently for Nixon. Maybe this time it's different. Maybe this time it'll work.
Crazy. Anyhow, yeah.
People want to talk about uranium here. So uranium spot price, it's up a little bit. Last I checked, I think it was $61. It just seems to be taking this little escalator steady and steady up, right? I mean, what do you see with this?
Yeah, it's quite consistent. It's definitely been just kind of on a steady stair step up. Sprott's been a very consistent buyer in the market. They haven't been buying huge amounts of pounds, but a couple hundred thousand pounds here, a few hundred thousand pounds there. They've now purchased 13 million pounds year to date. They've raised over 700 million in their ATM. And yeah, the spot price is, I think, just as of the last couple of hours, $63 mid-market. So it continues to tick up. It does look like sellers are generally holding on tighter to material. So it's not that there's no material left and the spot market is dry. There's nothing there. Like it's never like that. You know, there's always uranium around. It's just a matter of who's willing to sell it and at what price. And so Sprott has basically been a consistent bid with front month or front quarter delivery or settlement, because they're not taking delivery. It's basically just the uranium is held at the conversion facilities and it just changes hands when they buy it essentially. But they've pushed that out to 90-day settlement, but they haven't gone out further on the forward curve. So, but just short-term settlement, consistent bid in the market is exactly what is creating these results.
Okay. It, what is the, okay, I'm watching the SPUT, and I thought for sure once it hit, maybe I could pull up the graph here so that everyone can see what it is that I'm talking about. So if you guys are listening on a podcast, just click on the link for YouTube, it'll take you straight there. Okay, so here's the SPUT. I really thought, I mean, I'm not even sure if you can short the SPUT. There's probably a way to do it. I don't know, but I would have thought that it would hit this line right here and come back down, and it didn't. So now we're kind of in new territory, like when gold hits 2100 or something, you know, it's never been done before. You know, this is pretty exciting. We got to move the resistance line up where, because it, you know.
Yep. You're going to have to look at weekly or monthly charts and go back to UPC, probably 2011 or something. Well, that spike in September, interestingly enough, that happened while a couple of days Sprott's ATM was offline, where they were re-upping and getting, they ran through that initial, 200 million or 300 million that they ran through really fast over in the course of a month. And then there was a couple of days offline. And of course, Sprott's ATM is selling pressure, right? So when the buying pressure is heavy, they're issuing shares through that ATM that's actually selling pressure on the stock, on the trust. And so for that day, that big spike day, that was when the ATM was offline and the sector was going wild, and they traded up to close to a 20% premium to NAV. So that didn't actually necessarily accurately represent the spot price in that moment, because, you know, where were we at? In the high 40s, yeah. I think in September, maybe low 50s. So now that we're at 63 and we broke through that, you know, it's interesting. It's a beautiful looking chart, but I tend to not put a whole lot of technical analysis faith into the chart of actual physical commodities that are moving based on not necessarily traders taking action based on chart patterns, but really real physical supply and demand, you know, nuclear reactors providing energy, buying uranium, that kind of thing. It's like the utility fuel buyers are not looking at the charts. They're just buying the stuff. And so if it is trading anywhere close to NAV, it's going to follow a path of the commodity. But that spike back in September was when the ATM was offline for a second. Wow. and the buying pressure was so much that that it just shot it way up to a 20% premium to NAV.
Yeah. I mean, today was an impressive day for the uranium market. I mean, I'm looking down just the ones I've got in my queue here at 14%. We got 11% here for Denison Mines. Just a heavy hitter day, 8% for Cameco. This was my stimulus bet right here this morning. I just threw it in at whatever the market price was. So I'm like, I don't know what to do with this thing. I'll just put it in uranium.
Nice. Yeah. Well, URNM, you know, they just got taken over by Sprott, or it's in process still, but the shareholders approved it yesterday. They finally got the needed votes for it. So now that has become the Sprott Uranium Miners ETF, or it will very shortly. So that's an interesting development. I actually think it marks kind of a bottom for the equities in terms of how they've been trading relative to the metal. So they've been definitely trading down relative to the metal. You know, the Sprott Trust has just been going up on stilts, and the equities have been doing well, but relative to the metal, they've been underperforming. And I think it's possible that Sprott's takeover there is going to cause that turn. There's definitely some growing interest in that product just because of who's going to be managing it now.
Yeah, that was actually on my next question here. So it did already happen. They got the 50, or what they need, 50%, I think, to say yes.
Yeah, so they needed 50% of shareholders and a majority yes vote, and they got it down to the wire. I think it was within 24 hours of the cutoff date and time. And, you know, they would have just had to postpone it again for a week or two. But it took a lot of work because URNM is so widely held by retail that there was just a lot of international retail holders that, you know, maybe they owned it on the date of record, December 15th, and they sold it over the past couple of months and just kind of forgot about it. We'll just have to still go out and connect with these people and say, hey, you know, vote on this.
Yeah, yeah.
So it took them.
Check your spam folder.
They had to do quite a bit of door knocking.
Yeah. What do you see? I saw the same thing you did yesterday, and it was good to hear you verbalize it. I saw the same thing with URNM and the what do the technical guys call this? A golden cross when the 50 crosses to the upside of the 200.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah.
Yep. It's a classic indicator, and the inverse, of course, is the same. When it drops below a declining 200 day, that's a death cross or a bear cross. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And is that also to a lesser degree, like the 21 crossing the 50?
Sure. I mean, anytime you have a short-term moving average moving, breaking above a rising longer-term moving average that you'll have, you know, that's a short-term indication of a trend. And of course, the inverse is always true as well. But usually, you know, the 50 above the 200 compared to the 20 above the 50 would indicate a longer-term uptrend.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Good. So if you're not positioned yet, you probably should be. Take your stimmy check and buy some uranium.
There you go.
Yeah. We had the uranium boot camp since we were last on. That was a blast. I learned a whole lot from that presentation, and I didn't think I would be buying any more uranium, but I've actually kind of held off on my weekly purchases of gold and silver miners, and I've transitioned that over to uranium. I think probably the uranium's probably going to hit before gold does. Maybe I'm wrong, but I like it a lot. What can you go over? This is one thing that I realized I had very little understanding of after that boot camp. Can you kind of go over the process, you know, maybe in just a couple of minutes when you go from Kazatomprom pulling it out of the ground, you know, the ore, and then it goes into refining and then conversion, and then now it can be used in a power plant. Can you kind of outline that process?
Sure, yeah, just kind of a fuel cycle 101.
Yeah.
Sure, yeah. So the uranium is mined out of the ground via a number of different methods. The ISR mining, like you mentioned, for Kazakhstan is in situ recovery. That's more and more becoming a prominent producing method of uranium, especially areas with appropriate geology. You don't even have to have super high grades in order to pump out a lot of uranium, as we see in Kazakhstan. So it's just, it's injection and recovery wells. And so they inject some form of lixiviant, a fluid that will interact with the metal within the ore body, and then the extraction wells, which will suck it out, and then it goes through a processing to turn that into uranium octoxide or U308, or what is just known as uranium in the fuel cycle. So that's the ISR method. It's also mined in underground mines.
Is that the yellow cake? Is that
that's the yellow cake? Yes.
Okay.
That's a drum of this yellow powder. That's U308.
And that's what's Sprott is physically storing.
Correct.
Is the yellow cake. Okay. Not the correct. Whole pellets. Okay.
Yep, exactly. Well, the pellets would be kind of like the fuel pellets, which is sort of the end of the line. So the U308 is like a drum of yellow powder. And that's the yellow cake, the U308. And so that can be produced, or, you know, the uranium can be mined by the ISR method I just mentioned, or there's underground mines like Cameco's Cigar Lake mine and MacArthur River mine are both very large underground mines. They have exceptionally high grades. And then there's open pit mines. So like Rossing and Husab and, you know, the Namibian mines are open pit. So it's mined any one of those three methods. It's minimally processed to turn it into U308. Then it gets sent to a conversion facility and it's converted into uranium hexafluoride by essentially mixing the uranium with fluorine. And you get a gas, a very heavy gas, uranium hexafluoride, which is known as UF6. And the reason they convert it to a gas is that's the form that it needs to be in order to enrich it in centrifuges. So it goes from a converter to an enrichment facility where the UF6, the gas, is placed into centrifuges, which spin at very, very high rates. And that spinning is a separation of mass between the two prominent isotopes in the UF6, and that's U235 and U238. So U235 is the fissile isotope. It's less stable. It's the one that actually can undergo fission. And so in natural uranium, UF6, U235 is only 0.7% of the total. And that needs to be enriched up to about 3-5%, somewhere in that ballpark, in order for it to turn into fabricated fuel and function in the way that it does in a nuclear reactor. So that enrichment process is when they spin it really fast and the centrifuges, they separate by mass because there's an ever so slight difference in mass between the U235 and the U238. And so they bring it from 0.7% up to 3-5%. From there, that EUP, that enriched uranium product, goes to a fuel fabricator where it's turned into fuel pellets and placed into fuel rods that are specified for an individual reactor. So up until the enrichment process, it's all kind of the same thing. Uranium, U308, and then it gets converted to UF6. That material can effectively feed any reactor once it's enriched. But the percentage of enrichment and the type of fabricated fuel are unique to each reactor, or not to each reactor, but to each type of reactor. And so that whole process takes anywhere from 12 to 24 months. If it's mined in Kazakhstan, converted in France, enriched in Russia, you know, that could happen in 12 months. If it's mined in Canada, converted in Canada, enriched in the US or enriched in the EU, fabricated elsewhere, you know, that can take up to 24 months.
Now, as I understand it, Russia is really big on the refinement stage.
Is that enrichment and conversion?
Enrichment and conversion.
They're about 38% of the global conversion market, and they're 43% of the global enrichment market. They're the biggest player in both of those markets, the biggest single player in both of those markets.
Wow. Okay. And we do a very small percentage of that here in the US, right? In Canada?
We do zero conversion.
Zero conversion.
And, and very small amount of enrichment. There's an enrichment facility in New Mexico, the Uranco facility. And I'm spacing out on the total, I think the total number of SWU, which is the separative work unit or the way that that enrichment is priced and calculated. Uranco facility in New Mexico is something like 5%, maybe a little bit more of the total enrichment capacity. So it's not much. There is conversion in Canada. So Canada has conversion at Cameco's Port Hope, but they don't have any enrichment. And the US has enrichment, but no conversion. There is a facility in Illinois, ConverDyn's Metropolis plant, that was shut down in 2018. That's supposed to come on, back online in 2023, but I'm hearing that it's planned at operating at half capacity. So that's going to take some time to ramp up to full capacity. And even then, there's still a big bottleneck in conversion. And we've seen the conversion price just absolutely skyrocket. It's up, I think, what, 60% in the past 30 days. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Okay. That's exciting. Any updates on any sanctions around the uranium market?
You know, there was something that was kind of swirling around the Twitter sphere today about the EU blocking imports of a number of elements from Russia, potentially including uranium. It didn't look like anything official. I don't know how they're going to do that. I mean, the EU is just so dependent on Russia for oil and gas and coal and uranium. They can get away with it to a better extent with uranium. You know, basically the fallout will be higher prices for a while, but the EU utilities have 3+ years of inventory. The US utilities have around 2 years of inventory as this safety buffer. So for events like this, you know, it'll be painful and expensive for them, at least in the short term, for any of the utilities that are uncovered in the near term. But they technically can because of those inventories, and that'll give time for the entire fuel cycle to adapt to increase in capacity and conversion and enrichment, especially. Russia does not account for much uranium. I think it's 4% of U-308. And most of that is coming from Uranium One's joint ventures in Kazakhstan. So it's really the conversion and the enrichment markets. And what happens with Russia's conversion and enrichment, I mean, my biggest guess is most of that is probably going to end up in China. China is probably going to be just a net buyer of everything coming from Russia.
Yeah.
So that could mean that Chinese demand for Western production could be reduced because of this. That makes sense to me. But at the same time, China's growing so fast, who really knows? We saw CGN announce a $100 million raise last week, China General Nuclear. And they're a big, big player in the uranium space globally. And so, and they also have a number of utilities. They're just a huge player across the spectrum of nuclear. And I know $100 million isn't a huge raise for them, but it's significant enough. And they did state that part of the proceeds, they're looking at further acquiring uranium assets, uranium production assets. So the Chinese are still on the hunt. Nobody knows exactly how this is going to play out, but it's definitely a significant development for the uranium world. And the fuel cycle prices are just absolutely on fire right now, as it's not just U-308 with Sprott buying, you know, that's that one element, but all elements across the fuel cycle are all in very, very sharp uptrends.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty exciting to be in commodities.
It is, man. It's an exciting time to be alive. And it's hard. Like you said, you've increasing your allocation of uranium. It's hard to not be so bullish on it because all of the pieces, it's just all falling together. You know, I'm not celebrating what's going on in the world, but, you know, it's out of my control. So I might as well try to benefit from it. It's crazy. It's crazy how all of these elements are coalescing to such an incredibly bullish setup.
Yeah. Yeah. We can't stop them sending out stimulus checks to people that have no need for it, but I can control what I bet on with it.
Indeed. Was that a federal check or that California?
You know, I don't know.
California was going to send, they shut down. There was a proposal to temporarily suspend the gas tax and they voted against that. It was proposed by a Republican and Democrat supermajority voted it down. But then we had the following week, Gavin Newsom said he was going to send out $400 checks or something to help people pay for gas.
Oh, okay. I don't know. I think it was called like, you know, I'm a fire captain and yeah. I think it was called Hero Pay or something, or Gratitude Pay.
Oh.
And it was for working during COVID.
Oh, yeah, really?
So for me doing my job, they're just
I don't think I got one of those.
Well, it was my first STEMI check ever, and I'm like, wow, well, this is happening faster than I thought. We really are screwed. This is going down.
Yeah, the money printing continues, huh?
It does. Yeah, I was talking to a friend. She's got three kids. Apparently, you get checks for having kids now. I've watched and studied Venezuela and Argentina as they're going through radical hyperinflation, and they said it just starts with the government giving you out these little subsidies, universal basic income, UBI, for just stuff. Mm-hmm. And it got to the point to where people were being paid not to work if they were pregnant. So you got paid for being pregnant. It's pretty radical. And I think we're entering that now. And I hope we don't go through hyperinflation, but they're treating it like we're going to, you know?
Yeah, I know. It's interesting. It's difficult to find a fine line between appropriate social programs and just money printing that's going to hurt everyone in time. It's tough. I mean, in this particular situation, you know, the economy, everybody wants to blame COVID. I wouldn't blame COVID. I would blame the COVID policies that were implemented by the government. So, you know, they did that, and then they're sending us checks kind of as an apology, or it's supposed to make up for the absolute crushing of the economy for 2 years. It's like, no, I don't buy it. I
say that all the time, that it wasn't COVID that crashed the economy. It was government's response to COVID 100%. That crashed the economy.
Yep. I appreciate COVID. I appreciate
doesn't care about the economy. It's a little virus just trying to replicate. It has no idea about financials or any of this.
Right.
It was the government's response to COVID.
100%.
It killed it. Yeah. Okay. I'm trying to think of anything else to kind of wrap it up. Do you got any final thoughts on uranium? What impact is this Sprott taking over URNM going to have? Just to the upside, I guess. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think it's definitely a positive development. It's hard to say what the impact will be. I think that we're going to see improved liquidity. It would be nice. I'm actually hoping that they end up doing a stock split. I would like to see the liquidity improve and to see, you know, if they did a 3-for-1 or a 1-for-3, can't remember which it is, that would bring them down right on par with URA. And it would be much easier.
Price-wise, you mean?
Price-wise.
Okay.
It'd be much easier to see the outperformance of URNM to URA if they did a reset like that. It would also immediately improve liquidity, be more attractive to retail. And that improvement of liquidity will deepen the options market. And the options market obviously also drives up the price. As we can see, it's had a major effect on URA in terms of the outstanding shares of URA. And the issuance that they've done has been 3 or 4 or 5x what URNM has done this year so far. We believe that's because, you know, when you take a directionally long bullish options trade, the market maker that sells that bullish option to you, they can't be net long. So they hedge out by buying, they're selling. So they're short, they can't be net short. They're selling that option. So they have to buy the underlying common to hedge out and not have a directional bet. So when you see a lot of bullish options trades happening in any security, what's happening behind the scenes is the market makers are buying the common underlying. So that's had an effect. Definitely, it's had an effect on Cameco. It's had an effect on URA. And even with that, URNM continues to outperform URA, probably because it's a pure play and Cameco's only, or URA is only 70%. So hopefully they do that. Maybe they won't. I don't really know. I think that would be an improvement to the vehicle. But it's, you know, it's now under Sprott's management and Sprott's marketing team. And North Shore, they did a really good job with the vehicle, but they had a very shoestring budget in terms of marketing. So we should see a new marketing type of campaign for coming from Sprott. And now Sprott has 2 products that they can market to their own clientele in the uranium space. Maybe you can buy the equities here. You can buy the physical here. Bob's your uncle. So
yeah,
looking forward to it. It's a positive move. Yeah.
Yeah, I am super excited. I am so glad I found this sector, and you know, you've been a big part of that. So thank you, sir.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
Yes, you kind of supply the fundamentals so that I have a little more conviction of my bets. You know.
it's necessary. It's so volatile. I mean, for me, when I take a stock tip from somebody and I don't know much about what it is and I buy it, I get shaken out so easily. And even if that's coming from somebody I really, really trust who just has repeated huge winners, I still get shaken out. I always will end up selling even on a short-term loss, be happy to take that loss and put it into something I know. And that's just me. But for me, it's absolutely crucial to understand what you own and why you own it. And I have had, you know, small winners in the past and some pretty big winners on just stock tips from people that I follow on Twitter, somebody that I trust. There's some very, very sharp people on Twitter, by the way. And so I have done well with that. But at the same time, I get shaken out all the time of XYZ stock that somebody mentioned that I liked the idea at the time. I know nothing about it. So that's why I have most of my money in the things that I understand. And luckily that's doing very well right now.
Yeah, I feel the same way. Like I remember when I first got into gold and silver, when it got cheaper, I got really excited and bought more. You know, it's that's the way I feel with uranium. Is like I kind of like selfishly just want this thing to tank so I can get more. You know what I mean? Although it's probably not going to comply, but maybe if there's a liquidity crisis, then we'll get lucky. But
that's a good way to look at it. I like that viewpoint. Yeah, well, you know, if you hang around long enough, which usually doesn't take that long, every 6 or 8 months there's usually a pretty good correction regardless of how good the fundamentals are. So we've been holding through most of those corrections. What we tend to do is have a part of our portfolio in options trades, and so those obviously have an expiration. And so when they do, they dump some cash in the account. And the next time the market corrects, most of our holdings, we just hang on. But if we have some cash, we take another directionally long options bet. And that's just kind of rinse and repeat. That seems to work well for us.
Yeah. It generates a little cash flow, and then you don't interrupt dividends and have to deal with your long-term portfolio and all that.
Yeah. Capital gains. Yeah. Capital gains in the States. You got to be pretty on point and pretty sharp as a trader to have sufficient short-term profits to make up for the vastly increased amount you'd be paying on the short-term versus long-term. True. In the US anyways. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Can't speak for London, but I know how it is here. Right on. Well, thank you, Justin. You guys can check out Justin, uraniuminsider.com, and also check out his YouTube channel. I watch it every day that it comes out, the Uranium Market Minute. We will put links in the show notes. Justin, thanks again for coming on, and you have yourself a good rest of the day, sir.
My pleasure. Thanks, Steve.
All right. Take care.